Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. Under California law, cities and counties are urged to periodically develop climate action plans, or CAPs. A CAP lays out a community's roadmap for reducing greenhouse gas emissions over the following years, with input and review by community members and various stakeholders. My guest today is Rachel Kippen, who has spent the last year or two working with cities and counties on their CAPs. Our task today is not to talk so much about the content of CAPs, but instead to explain how a city or county goes about developing one, and whether it is an aspirational document or a plan for concrete action. How effective are these plans in driving concrete emission reductions? Do CAPs matter? Rachel is a coastal environmental advocate, writer, nonprofit professional, and artist. She has over 15 years' experience in educational programming, communications, and advocacy with the California Academy of Sciences, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, Catalina Island Marine Institute, guiding kayaks and crewing boats in Elkhorn Slough in the Gulf of the Farallones, formulating sustainability policy and climate mitigation with the city of Watsonville, and playing leadership roles at Save Our Shores and O'Neill Sea Odyssey. She authors a twice-monthly column for the Santa Cruz Sentinel entitled Our Ocean Backyard. Rachel Kippen, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me back. It's really nice to see you and nice to be here again.
Since you were last on the show, you've gone through what is euphemistically called a job transition. So what are you up to these days?
Yeah, thank you. I, as you know, resigned in duress from my former position with O'Neill Sea Odyssey, a decision I'm still very proud of today. And since then, really informed by that experience, decided that I wanted to take some time to work on projects, and maybe not be full-time for one organization. So I've been doing a mix of contracts and consulting. I work for the Santa Cruz County Office of Education in mostly an alternative education for high school students, doing a mixture of environmental justice and climate education, marine science education, and with the lens of kind of pushing back against big industries like the tobacco industry. And I also work for Alameda County as a contractor on their current climate action planning process, focusing specifically on government services and operations. Still writing for the Sentinel, and I've got a couple other little grants and projects that I've worked on in between. So it's been nice. It's been a totally new experience for me to try out the consulting contracting world.
And you seem to be wearing a lot of hats. I mean, various boards and commissions. Can you say something about those as well?
Yeah, so I have had a lot of privilege getting to serve on these different boards and commissions. One of the ones I'm the most proud of is to be a founding member of the Black Surf Santa Cruz Board of Directors. And we became a nonprofit in 2022. And that's an organization that was founded by Bella Bonner and really is prioritizing diversifying the lineup and making ocean access more reflective of our larger community, particularly centering the Black community and also other people of color. So I've been working a lot with that. I'm a board secretary. And then I serve on a few different commissions. I have the pleasure of serving as a third district representative for the county's Commission on the Environment. And so our job really is to make recommendations and advise our board of supervisors on issues as they arise and also that fall under kind of our work plan that usually spans about 2 years. A lot of that has had a climate element as well. And I'm proud to be the co-chair of Santa Cruz County Tobacco Education Coalition. And I serve it from the lens of looking at tobacco as an environmental justice and huge polluter, number one littered item on earth, huge source of ocean pollution. So that's another role. I've got a few more. It's kind of hard to remember them all. I serve as the conservation primary for the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary for NOAA. So we have an advisory council, and we have various seats like our fishing representative, our scientific research representatives, and I am our conservation primary. So we bring forward issues from the community and from our constituents related to conservation. And then again, we serve as an advisory role, right? We're not making the decisions for the sanctuary, but we're advising staff on kind of how we reflect back what are primary needs for communities. So
When
yeah.
do you sleep? When do you sleep?
Yeah, do a lot of juggling, you know. Sometimes I'm like, when are we? I need to get like a better technological personal assistant or something. But yeah, it's exciting. You know, I really like the fact that this has been a mix of what I've really enjoyed is having a mix of kind of like the government scope of work and advising governments and trying to really push those infrastructural changes forward. And then I don't think you can really do advocacy or pushing forward any kind of movement or policy without doing education. Those things really need to happen hand in hand. So still getting to have a role in educating youth and communicating with the public through my column. It's a nice balance. I really enjoy it.
Well, we're here to talk about climate action plans,
Yeah.
and you've been involved in a number of writing or whatever it is, a number of them. Maybe you can start by telling us what a climate action plan is, how often they need to be prepared, and whether they're required by state law.
Those are great questions. So, a climate action plan, I need a better word than roadmap because that makes us think of transportation, but it's kind of like a roadmap. It's a strategy that's adopted by a local jurisdiction, adopted by a city or a county, that is looking at the various sectors of emissions. And also, you know, I'll backtrack there. I would say it was first really kind of developed as looking at, you know, here are all of our emissions. Here is our big footprint. Here's our impact. And where can we draw it down? Where can we reduce? So that was kind of the initial focus of climate action planning. And fortunately, as we've kind of continued in our climate action planning knowledge, it's still kind of a relatively new thing if you look at it from kind of a historical government perspective. We've learned that not only do we need to do actions to reduce, but we need to do actions to adapt. We need to do actions for resilience. We need to do actions for retreat. So a lot of climate action plans started as a result of AB 32, which was the state of California trying to reduce our reductions to, I believe it was 15% of 1990 levels. That was in like 2006. And so a lot of climate action plans started to pop up voluntarily as a result of that. So it is not required by state law to create a climate action plan, but it really has a lot of good, there's a lot of incentives for a government to do a climate action plan because several of the sectors that affect the planning process already have other state mandates that they have to meet. So it really helps us be cohesive. And I have a quick example. So for example, like if you have a water conservation mandate, like water management agencies need to reduce the amount of water that is consumed because we are in a long-term drought, which is also a result of climate change. You know, they will be required to be held to that state mandate of reduction, but that reduction is also a climate goal because of how much energy is used to extract and to heat and to transport water. You know, you're gonna simultaneously reach these goals. So when you have all these state mandates, which we do, putting that kind of together and bringing in various departments and agencies to come up with a comprehensive plan, serves a lot of different folks' needs.
I mean, it sounds rather complicated. And we'll get back, maybe we'll get back to that a bit later. So what is the general content of a climate action plan? What issues and topics are covered?
Yeah, great question. So, things like transportation, right? Transportation, especially across the board, across the state of California, one of our biggest sources of emissions. But transportation here in Santa Cruz County is our largest source of emissions amongst each jurisdiction and then countywide as a whole. So that's a big subject area. You know, how can we increase public transit? How can we increase electric vehicles? How can simultaneously we incentivize folks to use these things? How can we make sure no one is left behind in this transition towards more sustainable forms of transit? Things like the built environment, right? So that's another thing, right? We've created laws and some standards in the state of California related to construction and new buildings. And so looking at policies that a government might have would be related to a climate action plan of, okay, when we allow a new development to come in, what are some of the things that a new development has to look at? You know, how are we going to look at the footprint of that new development and say, oh, well, you know, you're going to need to offset this by planting so many trees, or you're going to need to ensure that you have energy efficient lighting in your building, and you're going to need to ensure that you have water conserving devices. And again, those are serving multiple goals still, right, for the city as a whole or the county as a whole. So I'm looking at those things. The community resilience piece, I could say, is also more exciting to see more general public and residents being engaged in planning processes and saying, hey, you know, if we're proposing to do some sort of mitigation, some action that will help us reduce our emissions, is that going to have some sort of effect on a community that isn't represented at the table? And can we figure out how to also mitigate those effects, right? Or what else we have? I'm trying to think of what we have in mind. Current climate action plan. There's a lot of emergency preparedness. I mean, we couldn't be at a more opportune time to talk about that, right? The climate shock of having nine atmospheric rivers in a row, including a bomb cyclone, and being like, that's a climate shock. So how are we going to ensure that we have networks where people are informed of what's coming, where they can respond quickly, where we don't lose livelihood, income, and how we can not only be safe, but how can we, what's our next step, right? That's a big conversation we're having now in this county. What's our next step with all of this? I would say they've grown in complexity too, which is exciting, and then also a challenge simultaneously.
Let's come back to that. We need
Yeah.
to take a short break. You are listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Rachel Kippen, a coastal environmental advocate, writer, nonprofit professional, and artist. And we're talking about municipal and county climate action plans. Some people describe climate action plans as aspirational documents, describing, what should happen rather than what can and or will happen. I mean, can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I would say some plans, most plans have aspirational elements. A lot of that also has to do with lack of funding. So, you know, there could be a lot of goals that a government might have and want to put in play. You know, we have these relationships built across agencies or with the government and nonprofit organizations. And then, you know, then we're in a political climate where, for example, the Biden administration passes the Inflation Reduction Act and Newsom commits billions of dollars to climate change. I would say we're in a climate funding boom. So you're going to see climate action plans that are going to try to reflect that hope, right? But that doesn't always end up being what we want it to be. We don't always get the funding that we want. And then I would also say simultaneously, it's not a perfect process in that if we have an aspirational goal, you know, some folks might be really bought in and some folks might not be within that same government. So I can speak to Community Choice Energy being a huge gain, right? Saying we're gonna here in Santa Cruz County in the greater Monterey Bay region, create the Community Choice Energy, and same thing with Alameda County being part of East Bay Community Energy. We're going to look at having these renewable sources of energy rather than, you know, a single source through PG&E that's not sustainable. And that immediately, once we started adopting that, started hitting higher climate action goals that we had. So you might have people who are in these positions who are like, well, you know, just because we adopted this thing, now boom, we hit some big goals. So all the other goals that we have, you know, we did it already. So there's a challenge too with being successful. Like if you're successful and you have a big gain, sometimes that could decrease buy-in because there are so many things that a jurisdiction is tasked with putting their money and effort towards that they might say, oh, well, we got it now, right? We hit that mark. So move along to whatever else, you know?
I was looking at the draft Alameda plan,
Mm-hmm.
and I noticed that There was a section which said that the county had significantly decreased its emissions because people were working from home,
Yes.
which seemed to me cheating.
Yes. I'd love to, yeah. What I'm curious, what felt like cheating? I'm just curious.
Well, in the sense that, a lot of that had to do with COVID,
Totally. Yeah.
right? I mean,
Yeah.
it's not because, agencies were sending their employees home to work, right? I mean, it wasn't, right? It wasn't
Oh,
a
yeah.
sort of common practice, and it has become that, right? And
Yes.
transportation, as they point out,
Yep.
employee transportation, I think those are, is it class two? What's the terminology? Emissions. They're the three categories of emissions. One
Yeah.
is the direct one, the second is the indirect, and the third has to do with services that you procure, something like that.
That sounds accurate.
Well, and commuting emissions are in the second category because
Yeah.
they're not caused directly by
Right.
the city or the
Right.
county,
By the county. Yeah.
but they're associated with employees having to go back and forth. So
Yeah.
if they don't have to drive, right, that's a
Yep.
big chunk of emissions. That
Huge
seemed
chunk.
to me also, well, I mean, it was cheating in the sense that there's not really environmental justice embedded in that, right? Because the people who are not working for the city
Totally.
or the people who collect the garbage don't have that choice,
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can say that in my experience working with different jurisdictions, that there is often folks who've been advocating for telework and creating telework policies for this exact reason. Because one of the things I learned this when I was working with the city of Watsonville, and I had a role in that climate action plan process as well. And it was pre-COVID, it was like 2015 or something. Is that AMBAG here locally, the Association for Monterey Bay Area Governments, they do a lot of our inventories. They provide that service to local governments of like what sectors are causing so much emissions. And they said through their data that during like the furlough Fridays that happened, I don't remember when that happened, but when there were furlough Fridays with government spending cuts, that the transportation emission sector dramatically dropped. It was like
Well,
immediate data, of course,
20%, right?
that
I
showed
mean,
that, right? Yeah.
right.
And I think it's incumbent upon workplaces to try to formalize some policies around that. And you're completely right around the equity element of it, because if you're going to, there needs to be multiple layers of incentives. That's my personal opinion. Right. If you're not going to offer equal incentive of, if not everyone's job, of course, not everyone's job allows for full work remote. But one of the things that we've had conversations around is, okay, what, how can we reconfigure the work week even, because there's a lot of needless transportation and kind of, I would say, for lack of a better word around it, some like kind of old school thought in government of like, you show up and you clock in and you clock out. And that's how we like are accountable for our work. Right. But so many studies have shown that to be inaccurate, that people who are doing telework are often working as much or more because they're more efficient with their time. So how can we even
Right.
structure people's weeks where their commutes are less or where they're incentivized, where they're offered, of course, sustainable transit options, incentives for their funding models around that? Like how can we help use some of it's a cost savings measure too. It's a huge cost savings measure for the government. So how can we use some of those savings and funnel it back in an equitable way to other staff, to our community members, and to really also utilize unused space, because it's also creating a lot of unused space.
Yeah,
So
no.
kind of back to your point of COVID, I think several people, myself included, there were so many downsides of COVID. Obviously, it was tragedy. But one of the really huge gains was that government was saying, no, we can't do this. That's impossible. You got to come here, And then boom, we have COVID. And they're like, oh, actually, we can totally pivot. And being forced to pivot then further created that data, just like the data from the furloughs, to show that, this is really a direction that we need to be thinking. Plus, the added element that I hadn't really been thinking about prior to looking at telework through my current contracting is the fact that when we're going through climate increasing climate shocks and increasing climate disasters, that's a really huge hardship for a lot of employees in any situation. And so, commuting to work in a storm, commuting to work during poor air quality events from wildfire season, commuting to work if you have, I have a really old car, it doesn't have AC. If you commute a long commute in your really old car, an extreme heat event, my car is not going to make, it's going to break down. And you see all these other kind of offshoots. You see increased anger, increased road rage. You see mental health decline. You see that mental health decline amongst your employees. So really thinking of it from a, like, we need to have telework also as a, as an emergency plan. We need to be able to think about how do we deliver services in a way that's not as required or as dependent on needless transportation, I would say,
So we're just talking about storms and people working from home, but of course, in this last series of storms, power went out, right? And since people doing telework rely on, the internet and all sorts of communications, that raises some problems, right? And I was going to also observe another thing, which is that the people who can't work from home usually are paid less than the people who can, right? So, I mean, and your comment about all of these interrelated and connected pieces, we never notice them until they d disappear or they don't work. And I mean, it's an interesting observation, but you can't fix everything, right? Anyway, so okay, so we've talked about that, but you now were involved in. We can take anyone, we can take Alameda County in developing the plan, right? How does that happen?
Good question. So it, again, it kind of depends on each government. I can say, for each jurisdiction, they've been a little bit different. Again, kind of historically, I think you'd mentioned that, like, plans might evolve from former plans, right? So, like, you might have had a plan that went from whatever 20, let's say 2008 to 2020 or
Yeah,
2000.
whenever I write something new, I go back and look at what I wrote before, right? To plagiarize it. No, I write,
It's
of course. But just anyway, go on. Let's leave that for the moment. Yeah, continue.
So those kind of former plans had, I would say, focused more traditionally on looking at the sectors of emissions and saying reduce, right? Reduce, reduce, reduce. And so that's where they're like, where they kind of launched off into creating the plan. Okay, well, if we're looking at transportation, then we need to have our community planning department, right? We need to involve folks who create general plans. We need to, if we're looking at built environment, or let's say, let's we're looking at our emissions from our landfills and our waste, we need to bring in the solid waste folks. We need to look at our materials that we use. Those are kind of ways that I think it was traditionally approached of sec emissions, bring folks together. But now, again, with increasing understanding of the need to adapt and the need to recover and to retreat and to do all of these other things, you'll even notice, like, this is really fascinating to me, that our plans moved from being climate action plans to several plans are now double A's. They're climate action and adaptation plans, which is exciting because, like, wow, we're acknowledging we live in climate change and that it is here and we must adapt. So it's working a lot across departments, bringing in department leads from these different from an agency's internal internal folks, and then also bringing in the community through public participation, whether it be workshops or surveys or presentations around what is a climate action plan, looking at proposed measures and saying, does this make sense? Is this even feasible? I would say it's a lot of meetings and it's a lot of, trying to get folks to come in and not necessarily always couching it again in climate, but what are shared goals? Right. So there's so many things that a government is required to do. and ha is mandated to do. So, like, let me look at your list of things in your closet that you're so scared of that you're not going to get to. And how does that meet our emissions goals? How can we overlap in terms of our public health? You have these public health departments that have these big goals, and we obviously climate change is a public health crisis, so we have that too, right? So where's our shared areas? And then, kind of write the plan in that regard. So we have had stakeholder groups essentially that come together and share feedback and then start drafting. Usually it's, your Office of Sustainability, if you have one, or, not every agency has that, will start the draft of the plan. I think some plans also live in your city managers, depending on, again, the government's preference. And the sunrise and sunset of a plan is also up to that jurisdiction. So I can say, I don't, or I'm not actually a staffer for for Alameda County, but I can say publicly that our plan, this plan, is sunsetting in 2026 because it's 2023 right now. It's a short turnaround, and the reason for that is because it's aligning with the Vision 26, the strategic plan for the entire county. A lot of the goals are aligned with that. So then the goals, we're going to try to hit these goals by 2026, and then when we're going to do our next updated plan, we're going to have a lower lift for the next round because we've really pushed forward some of the big things that we want
Let's come back to that. We need
Yeah.
to take a short break. You are listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Rachel Kippen, a coastal environmental advocate, writer, nonprofit professional, and artist. And we're talking about municipal and county climate action plans. You don't know. I wrote an institutional biography of UC Santa Cruz during my last sabbatical. And as
Wow.
part of that, I read through the 25 odd strategic
Yeah.
plans that the university had prepared, right? And
Yeah.
one of the striking things about these plans is the extent to which the goals are not fulfilled. And the next strategic plan ignores the previous one,
Perfect.
right?
Yeah.
And so, the question, of course, comes up. So here's a strategy. How does it actually get implemented?
Yeah.
Right. I
Yeah.
mean, right. You have agencies that are responsible for certain sectors, right? They don't
Yep.
have the money to do the things that are laid out in the plan. There's a lot of reliance on private funding to try and take up some of these
Yep.
tasks, right?
Yep.
What's the follow-through?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's really hard.
I only ask good questions, Rachel.
I know. I know. Yeah, what's the follow through? So the follow through, I can say from the different plans that I've worked on, is again really dependent on several factors of, I would say a good plan is one where you can look at it and with your development group or with the folks who've helped really drive forward these initiatives, you can say, now I can look at this plan. I can tell you which are the like low-hanging fruit ones that we can, like, that's fundable. We can get a grant, or we've got strategy in here that's like pretty close to like almost writing the grant itself. So those are like really priority populations too. We've seen that a lot, especially with the, the California budget and with looking at climate through an equity lens, which has fortunately become more common. Anything that is involving priority populations and populations that are being hit first and worst by climate change. Knowing like the time is now to strike, right? You got to have some strategic thinkers and people who really want to hustle for that grant money. And then I would say public accountability is a huge piece of it too. Like never underestimate that because when we take these plans to our various leadership, whether it be a council or a board of supervisors, right? Having the public there and being like, we actually really care about this. We're gonna make comments, we're gonna send letters. And I can speak to, I was always impressed by that when I was working for the city of Watsonville, that even, there was public requests for like, where's the climate action plan update? And that's I can say that. I wanna see that. I wanna hear it. Because if you're a staff in a large agency and you're trying to get that agency to buy in to making moves on these targets, and you have the public, you know, driving, pushing, 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 saying, hey, you wrote this. It's a measure. Like, where is it? What are you doing? Tell us. And then that's going to your elected officials. And a lot of those people really listen because they want to be reelected and because they care, hopefully, you know, but that is a big piece to have the public pay attention to what your government agencies are making promises for and how far they've gotten on those promises.
How broad is public involvement? I mean, you know, what fraction of a city's population gets deeply engaged in reading these and reviewing them and commenting on them
Yeah.
and making demands? Do you have any idea?
I would say it's not as high as I'd like it to be. I think a lot, you know, if you go from like several hundred participants might review a plan, but they might review also plans tend to be pretty lengthy and also tend to have like a lot of stuff that not necessarily everyone's versed in, right? You might, and doesn't mean people aren't smart. It just means that you're not super versed in all of you know, various components. So I think that's the task of cities and counties and our just community at large. And I, you know, to not get too existential about it, I also think this is a result of having climate change denial for decades. I think the fact that we don't have the type of engagement and understanding of climate change is a result of the concerted effort, even though we live in a place that's very different than maybe the rest of the country, the concerted effort to not push this forward as truth and is backed by science and is something that everyone's had been educated about. And as like the highest priority on this earth, you know, this is our greatest existential crisis. So I think we're dealing, unfortunately, with a lot of catch up, where you know you'd want your whole population to have engagement in climate, and you'd want people to have the time to read a climate action plan. That's a privilege, you know. Not everyone's got that time, so you want to incentivize people. Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like I went off on a little riff there.
No. I think that's a really important question, because community engagement, I mean, I know with Santa Cruz there have been repeated efforts to reach out. You know, there have been various kinds of meetings and groups and the like, but the issue is always, you know, the people who keep coming back again
Right.
and again, right?
Right.
And the
Right.
people who don't come, you know, to them it's not relevant. And you know, there's that old it's I'll be pilloried for saying it, there's that old saw that a conservative is a liberal who has been beaten up.
Yeah.
And you know, in this case, a climate activist, you know, is someone who has been directly affected by, you know, flooding or some sort of climate catastrophe. Now, I'm not saying that's the basis for interest, but of course, people who are exposed to these kinds of things are now going to be much more interested in preventing them in the future.
Yes.
On
Yeah.
the other hand, they're going to rely on their municipality to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I think it's Felton Grove,
Right.
right, which re floods repeatedly, you
Right.
know, and it
Right.
never nothing ever seems to happen.
Right.
Which is surprising. You know, you'd think that particular community would be able to mobilize, but
It's real.
more.
I feel like it's so complicated too, right? Because you're hitting on these points that make so much sense of like, oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
That
No, I was.
are looking at a community that's affected by climate change, and I think that's also related to climate education. And so one of the tactics I can say in doing like climate education or even talking about climate action plans is not even always couching it in climate change,
Yeah,
because
right.
we're talking about your safety. We're talking about your well-being, and that as a way to bring people in where there might just not even necessarily not be like, I don't believe that climate change is real, but like now I've put it in this category that it's not for me. Like it's not the most urgent thing in my life, because we haven't drawn connections enough to it being the most urgent thing in everyone's life. And I think again, that's just the lack of the failure of our kind of education around it. and not necessarily people who wouldn't be engaged in it. Because you do see a lot of folks who are super engaged in it also being usually like having different levels of privilege, different levels of education
Well,
around it.
right. Who has the time?
But the time,
Who is the
exactly.
time? I mean, this is social movements are generally middle class movements because who has the time,
Who
right?
has the time? Yeah. And yeah, this and the poor people that are affected, not poor, like everyone who's affected, but the people who are affected in these emergencies and these, the flooding in Felton Grove, it's like it's so hard to say to a person who's lost stuff, lost anything, lost their business, lost their home, to say, well, like maybe we'll give you some money so you can rebuild, and then it'll happen again in 5 years, or you have to move, maybe be like, but who, that's a privilege piece too. Like, do you have the ability to move? Where are you going to move? Can you buy a house? Do you now your house is has no equity. So like, how are you going to be able to do that unless we really dedicate resources to transitioning folks?
One of the things you mentioned, you mentioned back, looking for grants, getting grants to do these kinds of actions. And the grant world is extraordinarily competitive, right? And so sometimes, a jurisdiction will get a grant and other times they won't. And it seems to me that it would be much more effective to fund projects out of, not based on, writing grant proposals, but based on more reliable sources of funding,
Of
right?
funding, right?
Which, and I realize that's impossible
Right.
under our system. I, you know,
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
but but I know. And the other thing you mentioned before is the Inflation Reduction Act,
yeah.
right, which has
Yeah,
all of this money in it.
yeah.
The problem is by the time it trickles down, there's not much. I had heard that Watsonville got something for some project. Watsonville got something like $120,000 out of this, billions of dollars of bounty because of this process. So, I mean, it
Yeah.
sounds really impressive, right?
Right.
And then when you start to distribute the funds, they turn out not to be
Not as impressive.
quite as much.
Absolutely.
You know, so we've got, I mean, in a way, it's again, it's the unfunded mandate problem, right? Which
Oh, for
is,
sure.
yeah.
Oh, yes.
Let's take another break.
Okay.
Okay, we'll come back. You are listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Rachel Kippen, a coastal environmental advocate, writer, nonprofit professional, and artist. And we're talking about municipal and county climate action plans.
I wanted to get much more into the politics, into the Yeah.
sausage making of this
Okay.
process. And actually, I have this long question
Okay.
about public agencies, and their roles and their competing interests. And many jurisdictions, as you've mentioned, now have climate offices and sustainability offices, and they take the lead on development of these plans, right? And other departments are consulted and brought into the process, right? But it's not really their responsibility, and they have other things that they have to do. Like the building department, has to review and approve permits. Okay. And so is putting this responsibility on specialized offices a way of avoiding responsibility in other agencies? I mean, that's still sort of bureaucratic politics. What have you observed this? I'm trying now to interrogate you about
Oh,
your
no, I got it.
involvement
Okay.
in this process.
No, I got it. I also, I'm an independent still, so I feel like, and I do, I say the people that I work with, I've been very impressed with. They're very committed to the work that they're doing, but
Yeah, I'm
there
not
are just these,
questioning that.
totally, there's just these fundamental issues, right? Like you bring up. And I do think that, especially over the last, like you've probably seen these offices of sustainability is like popping up more and more over the last decade. And that's great to a degree, but I agree with you that they can be looked at as like, I don't know, the stepchild, where like there'll be a feeling amongst potentially other internal stakeholders within a government agency of like, what do you even do? You're not what like you're not deliver you're not You're not delivering. You're not taking the waste away. You're not pumping the water too. You're not, what is your function? And then also then having these folks come in and try to create these comprehensive plans. I would say that the agencies that are looking at climate action planning related to their funding is really one of the smartest ways to go, in my opinion, because, like you mentioned, there's not enough funding, and the grant hustle is not always a reliable game, especially with changing politics. And the cities that are going to maintain their wealth, and I don't mean their wealth and like their wealthy populations, but the cities that are going to maintain their services are the ones that are going to address climate change and recognize they're making an investment. And so they need to have it at the leadership level, right? It doesn't it you can have your offices, and that's, I believe, I hope I don't speak incorrectly to that, but I believe that's City of Santa Cruz. They have, their sustainability within their city management. Their relationship is like very, very close, to prioritize the fact that this is now a part of absolutely everything. And it's not a perfect process by any means, because you also have so many different departments that are taxed with these things, and if they're asked to do additional stuff and it's not funded, it's like now your Office of Sustainability is the state mandator, right? You're like, oh, now you're gonna do this thing, but there's no guarantee that it's gonna work out. So it's trying to look, I think, at your budget often and say, what's the most bang for our buck to reach goals that we need to, that are prioritizing our survival, our ability to deliver services.
At
I
what
think
level now? Is that at the citywide level or at the department level?
I would say more at like the citywide level,
See,
right? And
yeah.
like it's like a inch, and I can say personally, I'm not a total expert on all of the political processes that create the mandates for the state. I've had several state mandates come down on me, but I could say like it would be wonderful to have climate action planning be more of a mandated piece and have funding attached to it, of course. But that's we're not there yet. And I think that's also another tangent of like we're spending so much money as local jurisdictions dealing with this climate crisis, and so oftentimes we're not even necessarily labeling it appropriately. So we're calling it other things, but it's the climate crisis. And we need to be pushing back ultimately on getting lobbying out of federal government and pushing back on fossil fuel industry and taxation models that there are people profiting and making tons of money that could help foot the bill for what's happened. But we haven't gotten there,
Well, I
clearly.
mean, all of that is true, right?
Right,
But
right, right.
changing that structure is a matter of political struggle as well.
Right, right.
Were when you were in these meetings, did agencies fight back against proposals? Was that a problem?
Not, I haven't experienced like fighting back per se, as more as I would say, like, that's not like the way that this is currently set up is not going to work. Like, just, and I found that to be, I think I've evolved a little bit in my thinking too, because I was really naive going into a lot of this, being like, why wouldn't you just do this? Just makes so much sense. Just do it. Like, come on. And then be like, oh, right. You have like 10 billion other things that you also aren't going to be able to get done. So having the actual honest and transparent conversation of like, this is just not feasible in this way. Like, we have to change this measure. We have to change this goal. I've experienced that. And I've ultimately appreciated it, because that's also what leads to structural change, right? If you're like, we need to do this thing, and we have no plan for it. Then you're going back to your city leadership and you're saying, how can we get a plan for that? Then you're saying, what's creative funding possibilities for this so that we can actually, strategize to make something happen, instead of just like having me or someone else just write it down and be like, oh, it'd be so great if we did this thing,
But that then becomes a distraction from the normal business, right? I mean, again, you've got this time allocation. I'm just,
Right, 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 right.
I'm playing devil's advocate
Oh,
here,
no, that's good. That's all
obviously.
good. Yeah,
And again, it's something that even though I taught politics, international politics for
yeah.
30 years, I've
Yeah.
only really become sensitized to these struggles, in the last three or four by
Yeah.
observing them much more closely.
Yeah.
Did Alameda County use a consulting firm?
Yes, several different folks kind of brought in for several, and we're not done yet. So we've had several
Well,
folks coming in that have helped, mostly facilitators and facilitators helping with community engagement too.
I know that there are these consulting firms now that basically do only climate action plans for cities, right? And presumably they have templates, right? And they come in and they basically fill in the blanks,
That
which,
actually hasn't been totally my experience, I'll say it. Like, I at least that with
well,
because with Watsonville, I Watsonville we did that too, but I we didn't have, because there wasn't a one size fits all, even if a
sure.
consulting firm wants to come in and be like, here's a good idea, there's a lot more nuance, right?
No, I'm not arguing that they do the same thing in every city, right? And I'm not arguing that there isn't local participation and involvement, right? But these consulting firms have done it, done this, and they know how to approach it, right? And then they know how to organize community
Or,
meetings or call, right? All of these sorts of
totally.
things. It becomes an industry in and of itself, which I suppose is okay. But it also does take away from local participation, I guess. Do you have any sense? I mean, Santa Cruz, for instance, had a prior climate action plan to the one that I gather hasn't been quite finished yet, but is very close. Am I wrong?
So my just to clarify, for my role for Santa Cruz's climate action planning process was I was an equity advisor. So I was brought in solely for their equity in an engagement of, like,
Yeah.
for lack of a better term, gap analysis. So
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not versed in their full achievements.
Huh.
From previous plans to current. But I could also speak to, I would say, like, for Santa Cruz, and even just knowing my, like, very limited engagement of, like, oh, reviewing the county's current plan that just went through review,
Yeah.
is that, like, then those same folks that are working on climate action planning often are in these situations where now we're in, now we're post, like, post disaster. And so a lot
Right.
of now they're in, like, recovery, right? They're like, a lot of what they've been doing is emergency ops and recovery.
Right, yeah.
So it's I think a really challenging thing when you have this. I think as a state, even though we are faster than so many other states, we were really late to the ball game. Like, everyone has been really late to the ball game, and, like, we should have had planning processes a lot sooner than we have, statewide and nationally. Because I don't,
What do you mean we're late to the ball game? Which particular ball game are you thinking
the ball
about?
game of, like, making climate action plans prior to the year 2000, like, because we're still, like, new, like, I mean, I know
Well.
2000, not new, but, like, the first plan that ever was created was, like, 2000, but, like, so many plans really weren't starting until, like,
okay.
2010, right?
Okay.
And so, like, that's
But
kind of,
we had Kyoto. Right. I
yeah.
in 2000 I think there was still a certain amount of optimism,
Yeah.
right? And I
Right,
think
right.
what has changed is that it's looking less and less like there's going to be any kind of coherent strategy, right, to address this problem. It's all going to be lots and lots of little bits.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, putting the responsibility on municipal jurisdictions, right, is almost a way of confessing that we don't have the capacity at higher
Yeah.
levels
Yeah.
to actually, act
Yeah.
effectively. We can
Yeah.
distribute money, but we
Right.
don't have the capacity to
Right.
do that, right? Which is an
Right.
interesting thought, because of course there are state agencies that do
Yeah.
act all over the place, like Caltrans,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so it does strike me that the political organization is not up to this particular problem. Let's take another break.
Okay.
Okay, we'll come back.
You are listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Rachel Kippen, a coastal environmental advocate, writer, nonprofit professional, and artist. And we're talking about municipal and county climate action plans.
Yeah, and I would say even to your point, like, you know, we have an executive order for carbon neutrality by 2045, something like that.
Who knows what it is now, yeah.
In an executive order from the governor, it's not enforceable. There's no penalty. There, you know, like, it's great, but also what at the end of the day does that mean? And so from a, you know, I think to the point of like, okay, well, if this is like our earthly survival and the best we can do is an executive order of 2045, hopefully we're carbon neutral. Yeah, that's really scary. Like, that's not the best news for sure. And the California tends to like lead, right? If California is leading and that's, you know, our role and that's where we're at, it's still pretty, pretty challenging.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end of our time together. And so I was just wondering, what are your plans for the future?
Thank you for asking.
Where can listeners find out more about what you've been up to?
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for asking. I'm planning on continuing to do contracting. I like the mixture of work. So know that if you're working on sustainability projects, it's something that I've enjoyed doing, the sustainability and education kind of mixture, and kind of have some grants in the works for next year. We'll see where we land with that. And another thing I did want to plug, the Democratic Women's Club. I'm not a member of the club, but I just know that they're doing a large climate forum that's going to take place in March. I believe it's March 16th. And there's going to be an update from some speakers about various climate elements. So I think that'll be a really good one. I believe it's going to be in Lookout. I might write about it myself too in the Sentinel column. Folks, feel free to reach out to me through the Sentinel. And it's been a privilege to get to speak with you again, and always interesting conversation with you. You got a lot of knowledge. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's intimidating.
Where can listeners find your Sentinel columns? Have you memorized the URL?
The URL, you can just search Rachel Kippen, our ocean backyard. And then I am I can be contacted through just the newsroom at santacruzsentinel.com. That's kind of a just general address, and they'll make sure it gets to me. So
So for those of you who still read papers, Rachel's column is in there every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also available online. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much. Have a great
okay.
day.
Look forward Bye. To seeing what you end up doing in the future.
Thank you.
So thanks for listening. And thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make Case Good your community radio station and keep it going. And so until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.